So today I'm going to talk about the Heart Sutra again. We've been kind of meandering through it with detours and revisitations and all that. But the part of the chant I want to talk about today is the part we just chanted. After you go through, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, the no, right? Then there is the line, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death, no suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. Okay? Another version is no ignorance and no extinction of ignorance, nor any of the rest, including age and death and extinction of age and death. No suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path, no wisdom, and no attainment. So what I want to talk about today is what no means, what that no in there means. This refers to the 12-fold chain, and I spoke about the 12-fold chain of causation and the realms and all that. In May. Remember, for those of you that were here, we had the show and tell with the pig and the snake and the... We could do that again, but... The 12-fold chain is a way of discussing or describing how ignorance works, how suffering works. Okay, so it's a cycle, it's a circle, and often it's each link is a chain. But another way of thinking of this is that everything melds into and feeds everything else. So even though it's presented sequentially, each thing impacts the next. So the first is ignorance, right? Ignorance. So when this other one says, nor any of the rest, this is the rest we're talking about here. Okay. The ones that are named and the ones that aren't named. So ignorance, in this case, means ignorance of the way things are, ignorance of the nature of reality, ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the teachings that tell us about the way things are and the ability to see the way things are. That's ignorance. That's the condition that we live in, right? The next one is dispositions or constructing activities, where the we have this information that comes to us through our senses, data, and we have we construct things. So based in ignorance, we have a tendency to respond. We have basic dispositions. We have ways that we construct our reality. Discriminating consciousness based on our dispositions, our tendencies based in ignorance. We see certain things and we don't see other things, basically. So we actually don't see things. It's fascinating. We actually, they can be right in front of us and we don't see them. Or, we may see a lot of something. If your car broke down and you're looking for a new car, and you're thinking you might want to get a certain kind of car, right, you see it everywhere. If you're frightened of something, you see it everywhere. So these dispositions actually impact our discriminating awareness. And then based on these discriminating habits, we construct name and form. So things take shape. We see actually cars and dogs. And this is all based on the sense fields, right? We have eyes, nose, tongue. Those sense organs make contact with something. So there's contact. And then when that contact arises, we have a feeling, positive, negative, or neutral. And based on that, craving, desire, grasp. This is the big, you know, this is the hot part, right? And then based on grasping, we have appropriation. You know, I want and I am going to have. So we grasp on to what we think is going to satisfy us. Remember, ignorance, foundation. Out of that, our world is created, and what we think is going to satisfy us, we go after. And as we all know, a lot of times we're mistaken. What we think is going to satisfy us actually doesn't satisfy us, or satisfies us temporarily, or satisfies us enough so that we really continue to believe that it's the ultimate source of satisfaction. Based on that, there's becoming. Now, this is traditionally taught in terms of rebirth, but we can think about it psychologically. We can think about it in terms of our everyday life, that what you eat, you are, right? What you grasp after, what you want, what your desires are, shapes who you are. What you invite into your life shapes who you are, right? So we perpetuate the deluded self through this process. What we grasp defines us. And then that self is reborn, moment after moment after moment, right? An ignorant, clinging self is reborn. And then we die. Then it dies. Now that can be a good thing, right? This ignorant, clinging self can die at any moment, and something new can be reborn. We can change. Things can change. So, then we're because of ignorance, we're propelled into the next existence. We're propelled into continuation of this chain. So what we want to look at in this chain is we want to say, where can we throw some spokes in the wheel? At what point can we actually stop this perpetuation of ignorance and suffering and over and over and over and over and over again? And there are certain places that are more amenable than others. Trying to see ignorance is very difficult because it shapes our world. It's like trying to see behind your own eyeballs, right? But we can notice what we pay attention to and what we don't, right? We can cultivate awareness and say, oh yeah, I see that. We can cultivate awareness of the ways in which we name things, prejudices that we have, ways that we construct our world. The part where the sense fields contact come in is so quick, most of us, we don't have a chance to throw a spoke in the wheel there. The only way you can do that is to sit down and really do concentrated meditation where you actually can experience thoughts arising, where you can actually experience the construction of that. So it's really difficult. But there's lots of other places where we can make contact. Craving and desire, being aware of craving and desire, what we desire. Again, awareness. And looking at our life, saying, what is this existence? What am I perpetuating here, and what do I want to perpetuate? And the moment in which we have the experience of things passing away is a very powerful time for us to open up other possibilities. So there's lots of places, there's lots of ways that we can work with this 12-fold chain. And this is important. We understand our minds through this process, right? We understand our minds. We take steps to interrupt the process of suffering. We need to do this. We absolutely need to do this. We need to develop our minds, develop our hearts, develop our characters. You know, character development is really important. we need to uncover ignorance. So ignorance, like I said, is often invisible to us. It's like we go, it's like a black hole, you know. You can't see a black hole directly, right? But they look at the universe, they can't see it directly, but they can see things that point towards it, that indicate it's there. And number one thing, pointer in our universe, is suffering. We notice suffering, we know ignorance. Say, suffering, something's going on here. What should I pay attention to? It's like a marker. So we aim to see suffering in our lives and the lives of others, and we take steps. We take actual concrete steps with our lives, with our minds. We figure things out. We sort things out. We use our intelligence to understand how to interrupt this cycle. We take steps to promote harmony and peace. So this is very understandable to us, isn't it? Isn't it? Come on in. This is very understandable to us. It's logical, isn't it? Okay, so does this make sense? Is it logical? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. It's logical. Right. Mm-hmm. So what is this business about the no? No. None of this stuff. Right? So this, I think, is one of the skills of a Zen student. One of the skills of the Zen student is, I was thinking about this, is we have to hold contradictory views at the same time. We have to be willing to tolerate. It's like this, 12-fold chain, do this, do this, and then turn around. Dogen is great at this, right? He says, the Zazen I speak of has nothing to do with sitting or laying down. Next sentence. At the side of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion above it. Right, so, it's like always, like, every time you think there's some place to land, and it's all very logical, whoop! So I like to think we have to learn to fly through the air. We have to learn to tumble. We have to learn to hold these contradictory views at the same time. This other view is that we have to embrace our lives, our minds, and our hearts as they are. Completely as they are. We're human beings. We're never going to be anything else but human beings. And we find our realization in the midst of our messy lives, not after they get all cleaned up. Okay? We cannot create a perfect self. That's an illusion. We do not live in an alternate universe, far, far away. Right? We live in this one. So, on the one hand, 12-fold chain of causation, work, 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 diligently apply yourself to this. On the other hand, accept yourself completely as you are. We have to learn to tolerate and live in and embrace both of these views. So we take responsibility for our actions and the consequences that fall from them, right? This is karma, cause and effect. This view of embracing our lives as they are, or things as it is, this is what Suzuki Roshi said, things as it is, not things as they are, but things as it is not a cop-out, right? It's not like, well, I'm just going to accept everything as it is, things are a mess, it's all okay, it's all empty, or whatever. That's a cop-out. We apply ourselves diligently, we take responsibility, we clean up our messes, we recognize cause and effect. We recognize that when we're angry or inattentive or grasping, that this impacts our lives and the lives of those around us. And that if we behave with dignity and kindness, that also has an impact. Right? We have a chance to plant seeds of wholesomeness. Each moment we act with kindness, we plant a seed of kindness. Each moment we act with dignity and give dignity to others, we plant that. So, we have to dedicate ourselves to that for ourselves and all beings. But there's a couple of things, there's a few things that can arise if we stick strictly to that view. First thing we have to remember is that the causes and conditions of our lives are complex. So we can devote ourselves as fully as possible to kindness and dignity and peace and equanimity and all the virtues. That doesn't guarantee that we're going to be able to control the situation. In fact, we can't. There are no guarantees. There are no guarantees. So there are a myriad of conditions in each moment. We know this, right? We know when we're in an interaction with another human being that they have multiple pressures on their lives. When we walk down the street, there's a bazillion things going on. All we can do is bring our best effort to the situation and contribute to peace and harmony and awakeness. The other thing that can happen is sometimes when things are going well, we may think we have the ability to control our reality, or we may think we're immune to the foibles of being human. Right? This happens with privilege a lot, right? We have enough money and we forget what it's like not to. We have the illusion that somehow our fear and distress and anger and greed have evaporated. Especially in family life or with a partner or with a good friend or with our coworkers, they're being cranky and unreasonable. And we think, well, I'm not that way. I'm a practitioner. I have calmness. But it's only temporary. It's because things have gotten bad enough for us in that moment to actually bring that up, right? I'm not angry. But that's false. That's a false view. Another delusion that can sneak up is that if we're good, we're protected from bad things. Somehow grief and sorrow won't touch us. Recently I met with a woman I've known for a long time. And multiple tragedies have happened to her in the last 6 months. Her life has been irrevocably changed. And she met with me and she was crying out, literally crying out, why me? Why me? I've dedicated my life to serving others. I've followed the Bodhisattva vow. It's not fair. Other people have so much. Right? I've been good. I've been a good person. Underlying this is the sense, if I'm good, reality will cooperate. Reality will pay me back. There's a bargain going on here. Without knowing it, I doubt if before these tragedies occurred, this person would have said that. This was genuine anguish. It was raw. It was a raw statement of humanness. Why me? What's wrong with reality? Why do other people not have to suffer this way? It was not a failure of practice. This was an expression of humanness. Yeah. our way of practice includes this crying out. It doesn't save us from it. We may not say, I, why me? We may say, I don't want to die. We may say, I don't want this. Not this, not this. I don't want this. No. That's what the self does. I don't want this. I don't want to see this. I don't want to have to live through this. This is too much. Right? This is so utterly human. Our practice asks us to include even that. Yeah. Our whole lives. So, it's not, this no is not a matter of I will never suffer, I will never cry out, I will never feel anguish, I will never. It's not that kind of no. Our true refuge isn't about trying to organize our lives so that nothing touches us or reaches us or that we're somehow invulnerable. That's not our way. This is the companion to the 12-fold chain in a way. Yeah. 12-fold chain is do it. You cultivate kindness, your world is dominated by kindness. Not because everything else cooperates, but because your mind changes. Your heart changes. Right? And you contribute kindness, you contribute awakeness, you contribute patience to a situation. But the other side is allowing ourselves to really be naked to our own humanness. To really seeing that the self does this. The self cries out. Perfection is not possible. This is the Bodhisattva spirit. This welcoming of the whole of reality, this movement towards no as a deeper sense of no, that includes all of our human experience. This means that we understand that peace and nirvana come not at the end, not when we've eradicated all suffering, but in the effort, in the intention, in the living out. In the, the self is kind of hapless. I like that word, hapless. I don't know where that comes from, but I like the word hapless. The self is kind of like this hapless entity trying to cope with, it's beyond its little capacity, right? And it's not going away. So we need to take care of it. Grief and anger and longing are not failures. Suffering is not a failure of practice. They are, in a sense, vehicles for realizing the no of no suffering. So our question is, how do we find no ignorance in the midst of ignorance? How do we find old age and death in the middle of old age and death? How do we find suffering in the midst of suffering? And who is that we that can find it? Who is that? Who is that person, that entity? What is that? So we have no notions of suffering and no suffering and what this no means. And that's fine, but we always need to go deeper, 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 deeper. Yeah. if we embrace with a tender heart this existence, this humanness, and we commit ourselves to engaging clearly with the actual experience of this moment, that the one that's actually happening, not the one we wish would happen, which includes a desire for something else, right? That's also true. Okay. Then we have an opportunity to realize the unconditioned. We live in the world of the conditioned. We have the opportunity to realize the unconditioned, to be released. So it's through the crying out, it's through the tears and grasping and laughter and all of it that we actually find this know that can kind of let us sink into reality. And we do this not just for ourselves, but for all beings, right? We have to remember that. So one of my favorite teachers, Abbot Obora, says, the spirit of the Bodhisattva is to find life at the heart of desire and grasping, not for himself or herself or themselves alone. He jumps into, this is the phrase I like, he or she or they, however, whatever version of that you want to pick, jumps into the blood-stained wheel of clinging to life in order to rescue all living beings. Now that's a vivid phrase, isn't it? Jumps into the blood-stained wheel of clinging to life. You know, is willing to admit to who we actually are and what this world actually is. So in our ordinary life, it means that we're aware of the self and we're aware of our tendencies and we're aware of our crying out and we're aware as we can be of our ignorance and in our various states of being, and we're not bound by them, right? We see the self for the self. We see suffering for suffering. We see delusion for delusion. This is what Buddha did under the Bo tree, right? Mara, I see you as Mara. Mara, I see you as Mara. Delusion, I see you as delusion. That's huge, to be able to see delusion. Most of the time, we don't see it at all. It like motivates us, right? The self naturally clings. That's what it does. The self grasps. The self cries out. And so we can care for that. And I said, who is it that cares for the self? Is it the self that cares for the self? The self is a facet of reality. It's a dimension of reality. It is not the center of the universe, right? We know this. So we can accept it. More than that, it can be an expression of realization. It can be a locus of clinging, or it can be a locus of awakening. It's up to us. Dogen says, we can only see as far as our eye of practice can reach. We can only see as far as our eye of practice can reach, right? That's true. We know that. All the time we bump up against how far our eye of practice can reach and how far it doesn't reach. And we go, oh yeah, missed that one. The eye of practice, however, is ultimately the eye of reality itself. It's the eye of the entirety of the moment, not simply our version of it. So that eye is not our usual self-obsessed eye. It's a wider vision that includes everything. So we have, this is a wise vision. This is the eye of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, the eye of Manjushri, the eye and the ear who hears the cries of the world. So we often cycle through different visions of practice. We may think we want to extinguish all passions, get rid of them, right? That's one thing. Life would be so much simpler, wouldn't it? Just pesky passions, these pesky passions, just get rid of them. Nothing, you know, just everything would be peace and harmony. Have you ever felt like that? I think so, yeah. So that's one vision of practice. Get rid of them. Out, damn spot. Right? Out. Or we may think we can manage or tame them. Yeah. So we come up with a version of a self that is basically invulnerable. You know, they're there, but really, they're just pipsqueak passions. They don't really impact us, right? We're too strong. We're too good. We're too wise. And this can go with them. Those people over there, they're cranky. I don't get cranky. Right? Are those greedy people over there look at them scarfing down all that food? I am pure. I eat only raw carrots. Right? I don't know. We think we can manage these passions. It's like us. One of my Dharma sisters said she was very. She said she was very judgmental about people taking pain medication until her back went out, and she found herself hanging onto the wall of her cabin at Tassajara, saying, "Give me drugs." So this is another vision. And there's nothing, see, this is the thing, there's nothing wrong with wanting to eliminate the things from our lives that are problematic. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with developing a self that's strong and able to not be swayed by passions. There's nothing wrong with that. This is another vision of practice. We can also find that we're doing this bargaining, right? If I'm good, the good things will happen. This is a vision of the self as God. I can control this complex network of causes and conditions. I have the key to the universe. But when we actually kind of mud wrestle with our passions, our grief, our clinging, we can discover another basis to our lives. So we have to be versatile in the way we practice. Versatile in terms of what in this situation is the most powerful or the most skillful or the most fruitful dimension to go with. The ground of the Bodhisattva path, though, is this mud wrestling. This engagement with passions, this willingness to cry out and say, why me? This willingness to admit the human condition and allow it to pull us deeper into an understanding of no suffering that includes the clinging and suffering of the self and the vulnerability and the passions and the complexity. So I want to read you one last section from Abhidhamboro. He says, we have to experience the world of release at each step in life and live lightly without leaving a track or trace. There is still the present world of ignorance and age and death, the world of pain and the causes of pain, but they are no longer impediments. Rather, it is just through them that we get the deep experience of being unburdened. And this is the secret of the repetition of the words, no, no. Yeah. You want to hear that again?
Mm-hmm.
We have to experience the world of release at each step in life and live lightly without leaving a track. There is still the present world of ignorance and age and death, the world of pain and the causes of pain, but they are no longer impediments. Rather, it is just through them that we get the deep experience of being unburdened. And this is the secret of the repetition of the words, no, no.